from inside the building to their police fans. They obviously didn't want to be seen. They kept their masks on at all times, didn't want their identities known. And it seems to be routine now for the police to use the pretense of violent protesters to attack independent media centers and to shut them down for periods of time. They did that, as you remember, Amy, in L.A. during the protest there, the Republican convention. And they did it in Seattle, and they did it in Genoa, and they did it here, many other places.
Right. You are listening to Enemy Combatant Radio here on San Francisco Independent Media Center's stream live from the Mission. We broadcast on various radio stations around the world thanks to Radio X in Seattle and San Francisco Liberation Radio here in San Francisco, and also to the Global Radio in its unknown location. We got your back. Thanks for having us. You're listening to Enemy Combatant Radio. We've got a great show for you guys today. And we are joined in the studio with Shannon Williams, who many of you locally have possibly read about in some questionable articles in the media, which we'll talk about later. But she's going to be talking about a case that she is fighting currently in the Oakland courts on criminal charges of solicitation. And you're listening to the Radical Tea Party, and we're going to get down to business in a second. But first, Subikini Kill. And also, stay tuned later in the show for some conversation about art, also locally here in the Bay Area, and how that affects the women. And we're also hoping for a visit from some of our favorite lusty ladies, so stay tuned for that. This is Bikini Kill. Welcome back to the Radical Tea Party here on Enemy Combatant Radio, streaming to you live from the Mission in SF 24/7. And we've got a great show for you today. Like I said, we have Shannon Williams in the studio. We're also joined by DJ Andrea. And I am Sunny Anarchy, and we're going to be talking today about women's rights and how they have... Where are we in terms of the 21st century, in terms of... you know, this women's liberation movement that has propelled us here into the 21st century, and what rights we really do have regarding our bodies and our minds and our beliefs and how we choose to live our lives. So thank you so much, Shannon, for being with us today.
Thanks for inviting me. Do I have to touch my
hand? Yeah, you can... We're so low maintenance.
Okay, yeah, that's great. Thanks. Well, thanks for inviting me. This is my first radio show ever. It's very exciting.
Okay, cool. And so, wait, so I have to let everyone know that Shannon did turn down Sharon Osbourne. decided to come on our show instead, so we're really excited. Thank you.
I trust you guys more than I trust Sharon Osbourne's editors.
Or her husband, like, coming in the middle and, of the show, and I don't know.
Well, I was going to try to cut a deal with her that if I would come on the show, Ozzy had to meet my son.
Oh, my God.
My son loves Ozzy Osbourne.
Right on. So basically, you were supposed to have a hearing today in court, and it actually ended up putting it off for another.
Yeah, we've put it off for another week while we're still trying to cut a deal with the DA's office or something. I don't know. My lawyer is lawyering. She's awesome, by the way.
Right
Katya Komisarek.
Yeah, do you know who that is?
She's so amazing.
Oh,
did she do all the legal up in Seattle?
Right on.
And she also NASA supercomputers. Yeah, she was part of the Plowshares movement. So about 20 years ago, she broke into NASA and smashed up one of their supercomputers and then turned herself in at a press conference and was in prison for a couple of years and applied to Harvard Law School from federal prison and got in. she's totally brilliant and super
Woo!
Political.
We should have
really
her on the
amazing.
Show too.
She is great. You should have her on the show. She's amazing.
Okay, note to self. But so it has been moved for a week from now. Why don't you give us some background on your case and talk a little bit about what exactly, you know, you don't even have to use all the legalese, but what exactly went down, and then maybe later we can talk about how that differs from perhaps from what has been reported in the media.
Mm-hmm. The police say that one of my neighbors called the police with a complaint, and that's how they came to set up a sting on me. And, you know, I guess that makes sense. There's no way we'll ever really know what prompted them to come hunt me down. But anyway, so they sent in an undercover cop called and made an appointment with me. And he came in and he was, I mean, the funny thing is he was really crude, just this really crude, nasty, like the very first thing he said to me, grabbed my ass. You know, he sat down on the bed and grabbed my ass and said, "I'm an ass man. Can I get some of that?" And
it sounds like a Snoop video.
Yeah, it's just like, that's really weird, right? So
I bet they were all fighting over
who got to come in.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, we had this very bizarre conversation, and I obviously should have thrown him out immediately. I was being dumb, but I really thought that, and I know a lot of people think this. So let me just tell you, listeners out there. Cops do not have to identify themselves. I have been told that several times. So I thought when I asked him if he was a cop and he said no, I thought, okay, you're just really weird and crass and gross. That's all. But they don't have to tell you. And like all those laws about entrapment.
Did you ask him like in a joking way or were you being like really serious? Like, are you a cop?
No, I asked him really seriously because it was so unusual, you know, for somebody to come, you know, to say that, to come right out and say something so crude, you know? So, anyway, so yeah, all those laws about entrapment that kind of limited what the police can do to, they've all been repealed and watered down. So they can basically all do anything to trick you into incriminating yourself or whatever. So anyway, we had this weird conversation and then as I'm lighting candles, people started banging on the door and, you know, the police banged on the door, open up, it's the Oakland police. And I completely panicked. I was in like a little teddy, you know, and I was just totally panicked and looking around the room. Oh my God, what am I going to do? Trying to get dressed. You know, that was my first thing. I need to put clothes on. Right. But they had a key to my apartment. So they had obviously
gone
to the manager beforehand. So they just came right in and came right into my bedroom, like 10 big, huge guys in uniform with guns drawn. Like,
you're kidding me. They had guns
They had drawn? Guns pointed at my head. And they're screaming. You know, they come in screaming. And I'm just in this total panic, freaking out, shaking. Like, and all I could think of was, I need to put clothes on because I'm, like, practically naked. Talk about feeling vulnerable, you know. So I'm keep trying to go to my closet, and I'm saying, I just need to get dressed. Please just let me get dressed. And they're just screaming at me. And then I finally realize there is a gun 2 feet from my head, and they're telling me to put my hands on my head. So that's just what I need to do. But in that instant, I just realized how easy it is. You know, when cops shoot people in the back as they're running away or whatever, mm-hmm. and the cops always say, well, if they hadn't done anything wrong, why would they run? Well, it's because when you have a gun pointed at you, your first instinct is to hide and protect yourself, right? So I just totally understand how those things happen, how, you know, well, why did they fight back? That's so stupid that they fought back. Well, that's your first instinct, right, when you're in fear for your life, basically. So they handcuffed me, and I'm surrounded by all these men, and then they pulled the guy, the undercover cop, they pull him out of the bathroom and handcuff him. And as they're handcuffing him, he screams at me, you fucking bitch. And that was the instant that I knew he was a cop. Like, if he had never said that, I would have figured it out later anyway from our initial conversation. But at that moment, I had completely forgotten our conversation because I was so freaked out and scared. But then when he yelled at me, I just thought, oh my God, he's a cop. He set me up. And it just made it so much worse. You know, there I am, like, half naked and handcuffed, and there's all these men, like, making jokes and being scary, big, huge, scary cops with guns. And then somebody screams at me that I'm a fucking bitch. Like, it just was the icing on the cherry on top of the fudge sauce of horrible situations.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so then they searched my whole, you know, they went around every corner like this, like on a TV
pointing
cop
a gun.
Show, you know, swinging their guns around the corners. I mean, I don't know.
You're Pim.
I don't know.
Scary,
it didn't make
Pim.
Any sense to me then, doesn't make sense to me now. It's not mentioned in the police report that they did that. The number of people who came, all it talks about is the plain clothes, the undercover guy.
And number of people.
Yeah, and my lawyer was shocked when I told her how many people. I mean, in all of her experience, and she takes on, she has a lot of clients that are fighting prostitution charges. That's one of her things. And she had never heard a description like that, like the guns out and the screaming and yelling and the number of them is all really unusual. But we haven't figured out, like, why, you know, what the reason is. There's nothing in the police report to indicate why they would. And the police report doesn't even say that there were so many of them there or anything, you know. So, so anyway, I'm crying and begging them to let me put clothes on. And I must have been like 20 minutes standing there begging and begging and begging. Please don't take me out in my neighborhood like this. Please, please, please. And finally, the one female officer who was there finally came and got something for me to wear. And what's really funny mm-hmm. about that, too, is that she said, well, okay, fine. You know, what do you want to put on? And I pointed to my clothes, a brown skirt and a brown T-shirt. And I pointed to it and she picks it up. And then she looks in my closet and hanging there, the brightest thing in there, she drops my brown skirt and pulls out this fire engine red flamenco dress.
You're kidding me.
I am not kidding. I was just like, I can't believe it.
And she made you wear that.
And she made me put that on. Yep. That is what she chose for me to wear.
Wow. I can't. That's like a story that you hear about in like some seedy like undercover like neighborhood where there's constantly like undercover busts and just people are just cynical and bitter all the time constantly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just such harassment, you know, the whole thing. And scary and, you know, humiliating.
Yeah,
all of that.
Seriously, talk about the Scarlet Letter. That is
And it's that
so
whole thing
wrong.
Of being arrested, you know. I've 10 years ago, I was really involved in civil disobedience kind of politics around the war and issues around homelessness and stuff like that. And I was arrested a bunch of times, but you know, you never get used to that. You never get used to that feeling of complete helplessness, even when you're doing it, even when you know this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to do here. I'm going to do civil disobedience. I'm going to be arrested to, you know, prove my point, whatever, get a message across. Even when you're planning on being arrested is such a horrible, you know, it's really hard. Like being handcuffed and all these big, huge people that you don't trust can just do whatever they want to with you. It's a really horrible experience. And this was, you know, even worse, of course.
No, right. Totally. I think, you know, and actually my, my housemate and I, who was at your rally this morning.
Oh,
you
great.
You had a rally too, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How many people showed up for that, by the way?
I don't know. I think maybe there were, between 50 and 100 people.
That is really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I was really excited. You know, it was a mixture of, friends of mine who, you know, came out, and then, kind of, really well-known Bay Area sex worker activist people. You know, Carol Lee was there and Terry Dodson. Both of them spoke. Robin Few, who's fighting this federal case on prostitution. One of the teachers that I worked with last year came and got up at the mic and spoke about what a great teacher Shannon Williams is. And this is all, you know, this persecution is terrible, whatever. That was totally great. That was really touching.
That is really cool.
Yeah, that she did that. And today was the first day of school. So she raced over to squeeze it in before her first class that she was teaching. Aww. So that was really sweet. Yeah, it was really nice having all those people there. Yeah, kind of a buffer zone between me and the media.
Yeah. I'm sure the media was out in force as well.
Oh, it was horrible. I wasn't really prepared for it. I don't know how you can be prepared for it, but you know, as I walked up the street, you know, several people in the media recognized me, and immediately all these cameras like turned in my direction, and they start running towards me, and there's all these cameras in my face, and they wouldn't leave me alone. Like just everywhere I moved, they all moved with me the whole time. It was horrible. I can't imagine being like Brad Pitt or somebody. It would just be awful.
Well, and it is weird because, you know, sex in and of itself is a really private act, you know, and it's something between, you know, people, you know, that, are, you know, are not obviously that, I mean, obviously there's different forms of exhibitionism and, you know, things like that, but inherently it's something that, you know, you just want to share with, you know, certain people that are your choosing, consenting adults. And, you know, so in some ways that it's almost like a double violation, you know.
It is. It really does feel like a violation. And I feel like I've been put in a very vulnerable position. You know, there are just all these mean, nasty people out in the world now who have ammunition for saying really mean, nasty things about me. You know, it's like, it's a really, yeah, I just feel really vulnerable right now because of all this media attention. And, you know, luckily I am an activist and I've been on the news before and I've been written about in newspaper articles, but, and so, you know, to a certain extent, I think it hasn't been as hard on me as this kind of situation would be on someone who doesn't have that kind of politics to buoy them, you know, and that kind of past experience. So I think because of my politics and my past social justice work, I feel like not only did I know how to kind of tap into the community for support, so that I wasn't all alone, but also I think it just gives me a certain a kind of foundation for dealing with it. And I just can't imagine if I didn't have that experience, if I didn't have kind of the political stuff to give me support and make me feel like there's a bigger picture here than just me being totally brutalized publicly. I just think it'd be so much harder. I just think of all the women who have been publicly shamed around things having to do with sex and just how horrible it is. And it's still happening. You know, right. You talking about, like, well, how far are we with the feminist movement, and have we reached our goal? And no, obviously we haven't, because this kind of stuff is still happening. Mm. You know, women being, you know, the scarlet letter, mm-hmm. being given out in public, and people still have these very deep moralistic attitudes about sex. And,
you know, before we even get into that, I did have another question. Like, I was going to say that my housemate and I were trying to figure out exactly how they had tracked you down, because your neighbor reported that they had seen, you know, people going in and out of your house, supposedly from these media reports.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, like, we're just wondering, like, well, how did they get, like, your name and, you know, number to, like, contact you? And
was that
part of that whole operation?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they just went and talked to the manager, because, I mean, I, you know, I was in my apartment and the manager has my phone number and all that, so.
The
manager had to have been part of the thing. Yeah, and when I got my check,
never trust your apartment manager.
Yeah, when I got my refund, I moved out of that apartment mm-hmm. immediately. And when I got my refund, there was in the corner of her check, she and her husband's check, it says, "This is the day the Lord has made."
Oh my God!
Yeah, so. I was like, ew.
Well, I think that just speaks to, like, you know, where we are right now. And I was gonna comment on what you had said, that in some ways I feel like we are totally, we've gone back in time, and I feel like we're, like, back in the Reagan era or something, you know. There's have you ever read this book, The Handmaid's Tale?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I almost feel, you know, and after I read that book, which for people that haven't read it, it's basically a futuristic look at, you know, where the world would be in this sort of moralistic future. But at the same time, it's very amoral. Men have stopped being able to reproduce. And so women have been schismed off into categories of, like, you know, wives that are incapable of having children. And then, like, these younger women that are fertile, they're breeders, basically. They're handmaids. And
right. There's all this infertility because of environmental degradation.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's, I mean, it's just reading it, it's one of those books where you're just like, oh, this could never happen. You know, this would never happen. And then by the time I was finished, I was like, you know, we've said that about almost everything that's ever happened, though. Mm-hmm. You know, something like September 11th, something like, you know, the war in Iraq. Like, this, there's something like the Florida elections. You know, it was all things that I've always been like, this would never happen, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's to the point where I feel like we're almost living in this surreal time where, you know, like, Clinton was a man that tried, at least he, you know, was suave enough to, like, cover stuff up and try and lie about it. But Bush is the type of guy that's like, you know what? It doesn't matter anymore. I can be totally straightforward and mm-hmm. just say what I want. I can say nuclear weapons are good. And, you know, the press will find a way to manipulate that into some kind of edible, like, aestheticized junk food for people to eat, you know?
Well, I think the control has become so absolute. Like, that, you know, back to The Handmaid's Tale, you know, there was this moral majority religious coup that took mm-hmm. over the government.
Right.
And took over all women's bank accounts, right? And something like that, I think, okay, maybe I'm totally crazy, but and into conspiracy theories, but I feel like sometimes the amount of control that the government and the corporations, hand in hand with the government, have over everything, over all of our resources, over every aspect of our lives, that, yeah, things like that could happen in one night. They could decide, they could get together and decide to round up all the leftists, because that's what happened in The Handmaid's Tale, and that's mm-hmm. what Hitler did. In one night, he rounded up every known activist.
And it couldn't happen
activist,
without propaganda,
you know?
You know, without propaganda, mm-hmm. without making it seem like this is the best solution for the country.
Whatever. Yeah, and the media, they just prove over and over again that they're just the mouthpiece for, you know, the police department in this case, or for the government, or the multinationals, or whatever. You know, in my case, the first article that came out, they used all these quotes from the police. And I had told the woman writing the mm-hmm. article the night before, I told, she read these quotes and said, "Hey, the police tell us that you said this, 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 and this." And I said, "No, I didn't say any of those things." and she went ahead and quoted them all.
Anyway,
and then those quotes have been repeated in every article that's been written since. And I just think,
so classic.
Well, how is this journalism? Like, they're not doing any research. They're not going out and finding out if what the police say is true or not. They ask the police, what should we write in this article? And the police tell them, and then they just write it.
Right.
You know, so, yeah, the media will just say whatever they tell them to say, and that's how most people know what's going on.
And other media will pick it up because they feel like, well, we're all the media, so someone else has already done the job for us, and we can just harvest their quotes out. That's so scary. And speaking of the media, I mean, you had mentioned earlier that the fact that you are a teacher in Berkeley is, you know, one of the defining, it's become one of the defining factors of your case.
Well, that's why it got into the media anyway, right? I mean, there wouldn't be an article saying, you know, Kmart clerk arrested for prostitution, right? Nobody would care. And I think it comes, I mean, it's a holdover from our whole kind of history of puritanical moralizing, you know, and looking into people's private lives and having laws regulating people's private lives. Less than 100 years ago, most teachers had to sign contracts saying that they would not smoke, drink, or dance in public, even though these were legal activities.
Wow.
Smoking, drinking, and dancing are legal
activities. Yes.
But teachers had to sign contracts when they got jobs in school districts promising that they would not do these things in public. And if they were seen doing these things in public, it would be grounds for termination. And women had to be single. Now, back then, sex outside of marriage was illegal. So basically, by signing a contract saying that you would quit the day you got married, you were basically saying, I promise to be a virgin too, right? So at the turn of the century, teachers' private lives were totally considered to be under the scrutiny of the school that employed them.
And
that they had to live these like morally exemplary lives. So I think even though most people don't know that, I think there is this kind of cultural legacy from that people have this sense that's been handed down to them culturally that teachers, people who work with children have to lead these very pure lives. Otherwise, what I do in my private life is somehow going to affect the children that I work with, which is, of course, ludicrous. But it's so deeply embedded in our culture that no one even questions, you know, it's obvious to everyone why this got into the paper. It's because I'm a teacher. Like, everybody knows that's why. It's like, that's how deeply it is burned into our psyche that, you know, from our cultural...
Right. And like you said, I mean, there's teaching, hundreds, you know, and hundreds and hundreds of women that are arrested in the Bay, well, in Oakland alone, you know.
300 last year in Oakland.
Yeah, for prostitution. And also there's a lot of them that also turn up dead, you know, or
that never
makes it
in
into the papers.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something that is a huge scar on this country's, you know, whatever you want to call it, the record, but in some ways on their moral record. You know, here we are preaching morality, and yet we don't care, you know, about people that don't have any protection under the law, basically.
Well, and that brings up the whole issue of legalizing prostitution, that, you know, the fact that prostitution is illegal sets sex workers up for all different kinds of abuse by, you know, like that serial killers target prostitutes because they know that if 10 prostitutes show up dead one summer in a town, no one's really going to look that hard to find who's killing them. You know, there was somebody in Seattle a few years ago killed hundreds. The number was in the hundreds of prostitutes killed in the Seattle area over a 5-year span or something. And that is mind boggling.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it just shows how, we still have these deeply entrenched ideas about women and sex and what's appropriate and what's not. And it all comes from this puritanical, moralizing, religious, you know, background, anti-sex kind of background that a woman who sells sex isn't deserving
of
protection.
Pleasure.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and isn't that too what everyone's so afraid of too. You know, it's not just sex. It's not just flesh or anything like that. I mean, it's pleasure. You know, we don't want people to be happy. You know, there's this conservative element within our society that doesn't, you know, pleasure is too, it's not disciplined enough. You know, it's not within the boundaries of, you know, everyone being oppressed or something, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's true. Like people don't like to see other people happy. You know, they don't like to see them having a good time.
Yeah. And people who are miserable. That's true.
You know, and I actually, you know, I would like to talk a little bit about, this idea of the legality of prostitution. You know, the Supreme Court just passed.
Yeah. This, I was going to bring that up.
The sodomy law, you know, like saying, well, hey, it's okay. But it wasn't even that they were saying that sodomy was okay. And they made sure that they wouldn't actually phrase it that way. They said, whatever happens in the privacy of your room is okay.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and yet we're still, you know, sending thousands of women to jail for having sex in the privacy of their own homes.
Yeah.
Just because they get money for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, the Supreme Court's recent decision on the Texas sodomy laws is really significant. And one of the justices said something pretty interesting.
Which
one
was it?
Let's see if I can find it. Scalia?
Yeah, Scalia.
Yeah, let's see. I've got it right here. Justice Scalia.
And Thomas was right behind.
Recently reminded us that state laws against prostitution are sustainable only with, quote, validation of laws based on moral choices, unquote. The majority of the Supreme Court recently noted the court's, quote, obligation to define the liberty of all, not to mandate its own moral code. Times can blind us to certain truths, and later generations can see that laws once thought necessary and proper, in fact, serve only to oppress. So that was a Supreme Court justice saying that, right? And there are other quotes from their whole presentation of this decision, like sexual freedom is one of the foundations of liberty, something like that, you know, like pretty radical stuff. Wow. In a way, right, to be coming from them. And it seems pretty clear. And it was also clear to them because I think they even stated, now, some people might think that this decision would apply to prostitution, but that's not, we don't intend for it to be used in application of the prostitution laws. So even they saw in the wording of their decision that it totally applies
it
to
totally
prostitution laws.
Apply.
And so that it's just inevitable. It's inevitable that someone will take their case to the Supreme Court and challenge the prostitution laws. So that's pretty exciting that that could be right around the corner. I mean, it takes years to go through that process, but if somebody starts it soon, you know, we could be several years away.
And yet, so we have, you know, this piece of legislation or this court ruling that is an interpretation of legislation that's just gone through. And yet at the same time, we have this new series of legislative acts that have literally taken this back to, you know, the dark ages of civil liberty, you know, and freedom, you know, rights within America. Mm-hmm. And one of those is the Patriot Act. Mm-hmm. And you know someone, and actually for those of you that listened during the Pride Weekend special, we had an interview with Robin Few, who is a local. She's local, right?
Yeah,
local prostitute.
She lives in Berkeley, I think.
Yeah, she lives in Berkeley. Mm-hmm. She's also a marijuana activist, and she's a sex worker who was arrested in, I'm trying to think, it was last year sometime.
I think it was around a year ago. I'm not sure, but yeah, the Patriot Act was used. And this is what,
talk a little bit about her case, because you're more familiar with it.
She's, yeah, I don't know all the details, but from what I understand, somewhere in Florida, I think it started in Florida, there was a sex worker who had a client who said a bunch of weird things, a Middle Eastern client who said a bunch of stuff, and she got freaked out thinking he was a terrorist. And maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. I don't know. I don't think that was even pursued, which is part of the interesting thing about this. Mm-hmm. She called the feds and said, I'm a prostitute. I have this client. I think he's a terrorist. And she gave them all this information about the woman that she worked for. And the feds used the Patriot Act as an excuse to wiretap 36 different women, I think, in several states. And clearly they were going after prostitutes, but they somehow used, well, we're going to uncover terrorism by wiretapping all these prostitutes. Because I think normally it's very hard to get wiretaps legally,
yes,
legal ones, you know. But with the Patriot Act, they were able to get all these wiretaps that normally they never would have been able to get. And they're now charging all these women with prostitution and pimping and, stuff crossing state lines and interstate trafficking, like all kinds of crazy stuff.
And that makes it federal.
Right, which makes it federal. And a bunch of these women have already been sentenced and they've been given 2 years in prison, which is really unusual for a prostitution case. And Robin, her sentencing is coming up at the end of September. So it would be really great for people to be showing support for her right now because she's facing prison at this point, you know. So, that is a perfect example. You know, anytime, and this is what leftists always say, anytime there's something like the Patriot Act gets passed and the people who have, you know, crafted it and get it passed say, oh no, this is only going to be, you know, if you're not a terrorist, you have nothing to worry about with this. Well, here's this group of women. None of them are terrorists. And the Patriot Act is what was used to arrest them.
Totally.
It seems like a really interesting juncture between war and sex, because a lot of the propaganda around right after September 11th around Afghanistan was a lot of women in burqas, and we're gonna liberate
these women, the women
from
yeah.
this oppressive culture. Mm-hmm. But the same tools that they are claiming are gonna liberate these women are the same tools that are used to oppress women here, and it's just like it's so insane. People are, you know, it's once again people are like these are things aren't connected. These things are, you know, one and the same.
Right.
It's really intense.
And we know it's all really about control, and they just use whatever propaganda is gonna get them what they want at that time. So
I was also wondering if you maybe could talk a little bit about sort of like how male fantasy plays into this, because you're talking about the history of puritanical conception of teachers, but there's also this history of like fantasy around teachers, like Aerosmith, Hot for Teacher,
uh-huh.
like that video was super, and it's sort of like, and it also plays into class and race, like a teacher is a different class than Kmart worker, mm-hmm. and so, mm-hmm. or Heidi Fleiss, so it was a whole different class mm-hmm. of prostitution. It's almost like this level of fantasy that mm-hmm. comes into the media, and it's
And the fantasy also with like, you know, all like 10 male police officers coming into your home. Does it take 10 men? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and is it even legitimate for it all to be men that are, you know, on the prostitute beat, so to speak, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think it's all totally related. Like certainly, the women who get the brunt of the law, you know, who feel it the worst are women out on the streets who tend to be poor minority women. So they get the most like constant harassment from the cops using these anti-prostitution laws to arrest them and harass them and abuse them and blackmail them. And, you know, there are so many stories of cops being really the worst abusers of streetwalkers, worse than their pimps or johns, you know. But then the fantasy, right, when somebody like me or Heidi Fleiss is arrested, that becomes newsworthy because we don't fit the stereotype of who a sex worker is. So that's more interesting and more titillating. And then, right, the whole cross-section of the teacher prostitute thing. Yeah, you know, like we all know that teenage boys get crushes on their teachers
right.
and fantasize about them and all this. And so how much of the people, right, you know, the cops going to the media and telling them about me, and then the people who run the newspaper deciding that this was a good story. Yeah. How much of it is about them, you know, becoming adolescent again and revisiting fantasies that they had about teachers when mm-hmm. they were kids. And then also this whole idea that, these fantasies of the pure teacher and the fantasy of what a sex worker is like. Well, you know, men want to believe that sex workers are these just crazy nymphomaniacs with completely uncontrollable, boundless sexuality
like
and sensuality that they have no control over.
Yeah.
Right. So wait, how could a sex worker be a professional when she's in her classroom teaching if she's a nymphomaniac? Because that's what they want to believe, that all sex workers are, these totally out of control, sex obsessed people. Well, okay, they're not. Sex workers are not nymphomaniacs. They aren't, you know, people who are out of control or, you know, whatever. None of that's true, but that's what they want to continue to believe and fantasize about, you know?
Yeah. And I think that, like, I just think that's totally disturbing that, you know, because you never hear about male prostitutes like being, you know, busted in the same way or treated the same way, you know, and used, you know, just manhandled in such a ferocious way. And I think that, you know, that's, there's something about being in that position of power and authority that really, it's like I'm justified in teaching this person a lesson, you know, and and how many of those men, I wonder, engage in their own, you know, illicit sexual acts, you know, that are not even visiting. I'm not, you know, not even saying that, you know, visiting a prostitute is illicit, but talking about, you know, doing just, you know, other things that are on the fringes of what the mainstream beliefs are about sex, you know, and here they are in like this position of, you know, community, like in the face of the community, I'm a pillar and I, you know, I'm teaching this person a lesson.
Well, two vice cops were recently arrested soliciting sex in San Leandro. Two Oakland OPD vice cops just a few weeks ago.
See?
So that's, you know, a perfect example.
Yeah. Oh, and, you know, it's just like, it drives me crazy. And I think that, you know, it will never stop unless people, unless men also start to come forward and like, and stand with the women that are fighting, you know, because women have such a powerful voice on their own, but it's powerful, but it's ignored, you know. We don't have a lot of women in Congress. We don't have a lot of women in the government, you know. There's still not as many women corporate CEOs out there as men. And so really the world is run by men right now.
Yeah.
You know? And I mean, I don't know. It's weird to think about being in the 21st century and people look at America as a bastion of freedom, this beacon of, you know, women's rights, and it's not.
No, really. It's not true. You know, like, once again, prostitution laws have been repealed all over Europe, Australia, prostitution is legal. You know, they're way ahead of us in terms of, you know, those kind of politics.
Well, and when you think, I mean, prostitution in and of itself, you think about giving sex as a service, you know, it's like anything else. You're a craftsperson, or it's a skill, and it's something that you enjoy, and it's something that, you know, women should be revered for in a lot of ways. You know, women should be worshipped, you know, as these people that are able to.
It's a nurturing profession for sure,
And it's also like a teaching profession in some ways, you know, because. A lot of times women, I think, are more aware of their bodies and more in control of, you know, what it is that they're capable of with their bodies. And also, you know, what it is that they enjoy and what they need. And a lot of men, I think, are just not in any way. And they're also not aware of what women need either. And so, you know, it's really kind of a way to, an opportunity to kind of enlighten men, you know, about, well, actually, you know, you don't really...
Yeah,
really
it can
that.
Be.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, it's just like anything else, maybe that might be a tactic to tackle the whole legalization of prostitution would be, you know, to really look at it as truly a service, you know, something that people are crafting for other people to engage, you know.
Well, I think just to continue to compare it to any other line of business, any other exchange of goods for services, you know, exchange of money for goods or services, that really, like, all of these justifications for it being illegal are totally irrational, you know, that it's, Like, I was reading in this preface of a book on prostitution, and it was saying, it was talking about the debate within the feminist movement, you know, that there's one branch of the feminist movement that sees the sex industry as purely victimizing women. And mm-hmm. that's all it is. It just victimizes women. And so it's just bad. And the women in the sex industry are being victimized. End of story. And then there's another branch of feminism where women say, well, no, this is another choice. It's a career choice. Women, you know, we support women's right to choose, even if that's what they want to choose, you know. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, it was a book about this split in the feminist movement. And the woman writing it in her preface said, you know, sex work is very, prostitution is very difficult to talk about and figure out because it's this blend of sexuality and commerce, and you can never, you know, it's about intimacy and this and that. And so how can we ever see it as purely an economical thing? And I'm like, okay, those are your hangups. Excuse me, you know, like that is all in your mind. That's in your brain. Like you're bringing that shit to this conversation. It is very simply a business transaction. Right. You know, like it may not work for you and you wouldn't be very good at it, but that doesn't mean that it's a complex issue. It's not a complex issue. It's just like if I were a chef, sometimes I go home and I cook meals for my family, but I'm not doing some degrading, undignified, horrible thing if I go to my job and I cook for strangers, you know? Mm-hmm. It's
right.
It's an exchange
that is
of goods or services for money. It's clear and simple. That's all it is. And, you know, like I might choose not to do some kind of job because I have some sort of personal ethical, you know, in problem with it that I don't want to do it. But that doesn't mean that, you know, someone else shouldn't be able to go do that job. That doesn't mean that they're, you know what I'm saying?
No, like, I totally know what you're saying.
Yeah. So anyway, that all really irritates me when people start saying, oh no, but it's so much more complicated than that. Well, no, it isn't, you know, that's in your mind. That's your shit.
Are there, women that you know of within the sex worker industry that, specifically that are prostitutes that are organizing in a way that, kind of like preemptively unionizing, if you will, you know, as a means to kind of fight, the current legislation and the current state of oppression?
Well, I know that Coyote, a few years ago, they were very instrumental in getting the Task Force on Prostitution together in here in San Francisco. And there were a few people in Coyote who were on that task force. And they actually, after, I'm not going to get all the dates and figures exactly right, but for a year, let's say, the Task Force on Prostitution, which also had law enforcement people and people from the community and people from the sex industry all on it, they did research into the issues, research into all the different ways of dealing with prostitution, and they finally made a proposal to the city council to legalize prostitution in San Francisco. That was the, after all their research, that's what they decided would really, you know, solve all the problems. So I know that Coyote, and of course that ended up, we all know that prostitutes are still being, well, see now Hallinan, is not charging anyone with prostitution, but the prostitutes are still being harassed. The laws are still on the books. So we know that that didn't actually come to fruition in San Francisco, but I know Coyote worked on it long and hard.
They're just also not protected underneath the law, you know.
Well, right. There's no, they have no protections.
Call the SFPD and say, listen, I've got a psychopath in my room, you know, and I need you to come and deal with this. They, too bad, you know. It's almost like creating a caste system like here in the U.S., you know, where women and prostitutes and women that choose to be in control of their own bodies are at the lowest level, you know, and as such, they become invisible practically, you know, until they need to be punished and then they need to be made visible.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between legalization and decriminalization of prostitution?
Yeah, and I may get them switched, which is the problem. I can never remember which is which, but one of them is what they have in Nevada, where it's certain forms of prostitution are still illegal, like working for yourself or streetwalking. That's still illegal. The only way it is legal is in certain brothels mm-hmm. that have, you know, gotten the proper permits or in the right counties, all of that stuff. And so I think that's decriminalization. No, I've got them switched. Okay, so legalization is it's still very highly regulated and only very certain ways of setting up a business are
like the cherry legal.
Yeah, so yeah. Those, and from what I've heard, I mean, I'm sure that some women have great experiences in Nevada, but because it's very restricted which forms of prostitution are legal, it's just very limited how you can work as a prostitute in a legal way. So you have to have an employer, you have to work at one of those ranches, you have to abide by their rules, and you have to work the hours that they set, and you have to see the clients that they tell you to see. So to me, that is not ideal. That is still very limited. I am much more a proponent, I guess, of decriminalization. That would be where prostitution is just legal, like any form of it, as long, you know, just like a massage therapist who works for his or herself, sets up their own mm-hmm. shop and has their own thing, you know, that a prostitute would be able to do that too, work for themselves or, right. and not have to work in a house.
Yeah. And I actually talked with one of the madams from one of the brothels in Nevada, and it's like the Cherry Farm. Mm-hmm. It's actually kind of famous in that area, and we all like sat down and had a cup of tea, and we were talking about, you know, the just how different a woman's life can be when she has like this stability of knowing that she can be okay with what she's doing and have support from the community and just not face, you know, continual harassment all the mm-hmm. time, you know? And
oh yeah, I'm sure it's a huge improvement over the situation we
have
here.
And it was like, you know, we're able to just, you know, do our jobs better as well. And we're able to, you know, offer better services because we, you know, we have a family now. Mm-hmm. We have a larger family in the community that everyone looks out for everyone else, you know, mm-hmm. and no one can abuse someone else and get away with that. You know, it won't happen here.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. Power. Yeah, that's great.
You know? So, and I think that's kind of what's happening surrounding your case right now with all these, you know, people coming out to your rally and, you know, coming out to support your mm-hmm. the trial date. And
yeah, it was really great. The night before my first court date, so a week ago, I just, you know, the article had just come out. You know, Katya and I had thought originally that it was just going to be like any other case and we would just go to court and deal with it. And, you know, no one would have to know. My, you know, Berkeley Unified wouldn't know. Nobody would have to know. We're just dealing with my personal life, you know. And then when the article came out the day before my court date, it just sent me reeling, right? And so for the next 24 hours, you know, I found out at like 5 o'clock the day before my court date that it was in the media, you know, and that the press had called the superintendent of Berkeley Unified, you know, and my old principal and all this. So the night before my court date, I just basically just totally broke down and begged my lawyer if she could, I just stay home, because I knew that the media would be there and there'd be cameras. And I just totally broke down. I was like, I can't go. I can't do this. I just can't do it. I can't walk out in front of a bunch of cameras. And then I made this comment to her. I said, I just wish that one of those, you know, someone like Kara Lee or, you know, somebody from Coyote could come and say all the things that I would want to say, but I just don't feel capable of doing it for myself, mm-hmm. you know? And Katya just said, oh, well, we can do that. And she got on the phone at like 7 o'clock the night before my court date. And she just started calling people in Coyote and whatever, all these people. And boom, the next morning there were people there with me and they got on in front of the camera and they spoke and said all of the wonderful, eloquent things that I wished that I could say, but couldn't because I was an emotional wreck, you know? So yeah, the I don't know if I'd been arrested in Des Moines, Idaho if I would have had that option, you know. But since I'm here in the Bay Area and there's this history of radical women and a history of a radical movement in the sex industry here, that I had that community to tap into immediately, really was just made the whole situation so much better.
Right. Mm-hmm. And how, what, you know, in terms of your actual, like, teaching over it in Berkeley, like, how has the school been in terms of support? And
well, they haven't, as far as I know, they haven't really come out and made any public statements or anything. I mean, I wasn't planning on working this year. I had told the director of my program in June that I was going to take the year off. So it's not a situation like I'm currently employed there, and so maybe they're going to try to fire me, or they're publicly coming out and saying this has nothing to do with her teaching, you know, or whatever. I mean, it's mm-hmm. sort of a non-issue, except in the media,
right?
I mean, they have said, well, she's not working here and doesn't really have anything to do with us, and so they haven't really come out and made any statements about it, either supporting me or not supporting me, because they don't really need to. It's not a situation like that. So, you know, whether I could ever teach there again, I won't really know until I decide I want to go back to teaching and go and apply for a job. I won't know until that happens, like, how this has affected it. I know that a lot of people in the district are totally supportive. Like, the director where I used to work has gotten tons of phone calls from people who work in the district calling to say, you know, tell Shannon we support her. Tell Shannon we think this is all bullshit. Tell her we're so sorry this has happened. So I know that unofficially I have a lot of support. That's from really people cool. who work there. Yeah. Now officially, I don't know, you know, I don't know whether if I tried to go back and work there again, if they would feel like if they hired me, they'd be setting themselves up for some kind of public scandal, you know, if people in the community made a big fuss about it. So I don't know if they would be worried about that and would not want to hire me because of that, or if in a couple of years, everyone will have kind of forgotten about it. You know, I mean, no one will ever really forget about it. The people who know me, you know, won't mm-hmm. ever totally forget about it. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not going to know until I'm ready to go back to teaching whether this has had a long-term effect or not. So that's pretty nerve-wracking, right? Because I love teaching. You know, it's my chosen career. I love teaching.
What do you teach?
So it'll be really tragic if I can't ever teach again because of this. I teach biology and environmental science.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
But I know, I totally understand though, because that is something that, it's so weird. Like, they almost make you pass a personality test before you can be a teacher, you know, because it's like outcries over teachers that are, you know, that have come out publicly and said they were gay, you know, and
yeah,
it's like, oh,
you
must be a pedophile. And it's like,
right.
Well, I'm a sex worker. Well, oh, you must be a pedophile, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
I have been totally thinking about that, like, wow, this, you know, the way I'm feeling right now must be how a gay teacher felt 10 or 15 or 20 years ago if they were publicly outed as being gay and then their, you know, their jobs came under scrutiny. And, you know, it's a similar sort of idea, in that, you know, it used to be that people thought that gay men and women were sexually depraved and had no
right.
control over their sexuality, and so of course children weren't safe around them. Well, of course that's absolutely untrue, but a lot of people still have the same ideas, like we were saying earlier, about prostitutes, that they're nymphomaniacs and they have this uncontrollable sexuality, so how could they possibly be professional when working with kids? It's, you know, it's there are similarities there, and I've been thinking about that a lot. That,
I mean, and the thing is that kids today especially are, because I also teach, I do art, like the after-school art stuff over at Willard Middle School, and then my housemate teaches the gardening and sustainable, like, living class over at Willard as well. And during the anti-war protests, a lot of the kids came up to her, and it's a, like a middle school, it's like mm-hmm. a junior high, and a lot of them came up and said, you know what, I'm kind of interested in what's going on. I kind of want to make flyers, and I've been seeing a lot of stuff about people are going to be walking out of school, and I would like to participate in that too. And she's like, all right, well, you know, yeah, I'll totally help you guys make flyers. She printed some off from them for them in the teacher's lounge, and she got called into the principal's office, and they said, you know, what the hell are you doing? Like, you can't do this. You can't. Well, the kids asked me, you know, mm-hmm. And that at that point is when they started chaining the gates, and they locked the kids into the school basically, and told them that if any of them left, they would get in big trouble. And mm-hmm. two of the kids ended up, well first of all, this mysterious person came and like cut the locks on all of the gates early in the morning and left them in our front yard with a note that said just like, go for it, like fight the fight or whatever. And Suzanne's uh-huh. like, oh my gosh, you know. And so then you know, some of the kids decided that they were still going to walk out, and three of them went out and had their little signs. But then the parents ended up calling and said, well, my kids would never have done this on their own, so it must have been the teacher. Teacher influenced them. The teacher, you know, criminalized them. Like, we don't want them to be like those protesters that are getting arrested, you know. And it becomes this thing like, you know, the teachers really are the guardians of the kids, you know. Like, at some point, you know, don't you want your child to like be in reality and have your child, you know, explore their opinions and explore mm-hmm. their needs and stuff in a safe environment? And it's like, no, we want our kids to, you know, spell and.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Well, that has always been a debate in education, right? Since Socrates, right? Like, mm-hmm. isn't that what he was convicted of? Was teaching the youth, you know, some bad political thing he wasn't supposed to be teaching? Yeah. So that is an ageless debate over the role of educators. And it is, you know, I think it is a really interesting debate. Cause you know, I've always felt like I would even rather have like a totally right wing, teacher, than someone who never espoused any thoughts about anything.
Right.
Right. Like, you know, I'm the kind of person who feels like you learn a lot more when a teacher shows who they are and what they believe in and puts that out there for you. And then as a student, you can learn from that and you can decide like what makes sense and what doesn't. And, it's more intellectually stimulating, right? To be getting viewpoints and ideas to battle with or embrace or not or whatever, rather than to have a teacher who just pretends that they have no thoughts about anything like that. And I think that, you know, the reason even as a kid that I felt like I would so much rather listen to somebody spouting, you know, stuff that I totally disagree with, is because I've always believed that kids are not just these malleable lumps of clay that are totally easily influenced. You just pour your ideas into them and they completely embrace them, you know. I really believe that kids have reasoning faculties, you know. They can listen to stuff, they can think about it, they can decide what's right and wrong.
Right.
And I think that this idea that teachers should never talk about politics with kids or religion with kids or whatever comes from this this belief that children can't think and can't make decisions for themselves, right? So to me, it's a really patronizing attitude towards children. A very disrespectful attitude towards children to think that you have to protect them from other people's ideas.
Right.
Right. And, you know, kids
it's
are smarter
really
than that.
Unrealistic too. You know,
it's also very unrealistic.
You know, like
to think that you're going to keep your
kids
from ever hearing about any
of
that
and
stuff.
And most of them already have like very, you know, graphic or, you know, or they have very strong opinions and a lot of knowledge about what's going on. And, you know, and some of it is, you know, stuff they may have heard from friends. And so wouldn't you rather have someone be able to tell them the accurate truth about mm-hmm. something than rather than have them go off and do something potentially dangerous because they think this is how things work, you mm-hmm. know? And I used to also be like a counselor in a youth program, and there was like older teens, and many of them, you know, like 15 years old, 13 through 15. And many of them have been in relationships since they were, you know, 11 or 12 years old. And they were sexual relationships. And I'm like, you know, these kids need to be taught how to use contraceptives. They need to be taught about safe sex. And it was like this totally taboo topic that it's like, well, you can get fired for that. Mm-hmm. If you give them contraceptives, you can be fired. If you talk about it, you can be fired. You know, if you talk about, if you recommend that they go and seek counseling from Planned Parenthood, you can be fired. And it was like, you know, how is this possible? You know, how is it possible that they would risk a kid's life because, you know, they get a sexually transmitted disease or they, you know, get pregnant, then, you know, not then just keep completely silent about it. It's totally insane.
Yeah, it's very irrational.
You know? And then you find out later, of course, that those organizations are funded by, you know, grants, like, you know, from church organizations or something. And so you're like, oh, I see.
You know, oh, that you were working for?
Yeah. And well, it's yeah. just... You know, it's like community organizations, but then you find out that, well, Mrs. and, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Poindexter are actually devout Catholics, and they, you know, they don't approve of sex being taught. I'm like, well, obviously I'm not teaching them how to have sex. You know, I'm teaching them that, you know, there's certain precautions that they need to take if they're going to be sexually active, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you know they already are, and that they yeah. need to know about these precautions.
And yeah. the silence, it's just deafening, and it totally kills. So mm-hmm. do you have anything else that you want to, you know, add to this or that you want to say, you know, to people that want to come out and support you, that want to help?
Well,
anyone you'd like to
I don't know, people, yeah, like people like keep calling and asking, how can we help? How can we help? And, you know, the actual legal aspect of it is really very simple. You know, we're talking about misdemeanor charges and, my lawyer's totally on top of it. And I feel like that's really taken care of. I'm not worried about that. You know, so yeah, what can people do? Well, maybe people, I mean, I feel kind of silly even telling people this, but maybe letters to the editor, you know, I don't know, continue yeah. the public debate somehow, you
or
know,
just to say like, where did you get your facts from? You
know, like, oh yeah. Yeah. Like, call your local paper to task, you know, say like, where did you get this information? And is this real journalism if you're not checking your facts? And I think you know, to me, one of the really upsetting things, and of course this is my personal thing, I don't know how much of a big issue this is or if it's just my personal thing because it's my life that's been sledgehammered, but, you know, I think we were talking about this before, the whole yellow journalism thing, mm-hmm. like, you know, that here these are newspapers, they're not, you know, the tabloids, and they chose, you know, is my story really worthy of being put in the newspaper?
Right.
And, you know, we're in the middle of a war. I mean, we're still at war. Okay. And, you know, there's all these
yeah, there's people dying
things going
and
on. Yeah. And you're choosing to take up space to talk about a teacher prostitute, ooh, you know, and the whole thing that, for one thing, it's just not hardcore news. And that the only reason they put it in there is because, obviously, we all know this is true, is because it's a titillating, scandalous story about sex, you know? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they seem to put this, could be interpreted as a sympathetic bias to it or sympathetic leanings when they talk about, well, teachers don't make enough money and a lot of teachers have to have another job, you know, to make
right.
ends meet.
That was
but they just possibly lost my job as a teacher. Like,
yeah, like you care
now
about
now I'm
how
making
much I
even
paid.
Less money, you know, because now I can't teach anymore. And, you know, just that they cloak themselves as possibly, you know, being sympathetic when they had to have known by running that article that they were putting my career as a teacher in jeopardy. And that just infuriates me, that kind of complete disrespect, lack of ethics, lack of, you know, any kind of conscientiousness about what they're doing.
And when you do read about prostitution, it's always like, a prostitute was found, blah, 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 you know, and it's just like, I rarely have I ever seen them, you know, divulge a person's full name, you know. And so brazenly and use it over and over like
yeah.
to flaunt the fact that like I can do this and I can
yeah
I can
it's totally just like scandal. They're trying to spread scandal. Is that really what, you know, what the San Francisco Chronicle should be doing? Is that the purpose of their paper? Well, of course we all know that yes, that is
that
what
is
do.
The purpose of the Chronicle.
You know, but
and our job is to spread scandal about the Chronicle, so
So, yeah, I guess if people want to, you know, be supportive of the cause, yeah, you know, go after the local media and be like, what the hell? Right. Why are you wasting time and money to, you know, mess up somebody's life for no good reason? And, you know, and I haven't been convicted of anything either. Like, that's the other thing, this whole, like, convicted in the press.
Guilty,
like,
until
I haven't been convicted of prostitution. I'm not going to be convicted of prostitution. I'm not going to have a conviction for prostitution on my record. But everyone who knows me in the Bay Area now thinks I'm a prostitute. Like, there's no question in their mind that I am, even though my case isn't settled. Mm-hmm. I haven't been convicted of anything, but everyone knows it's true, right? Like, everyone thinks that they know it's true. So that's just infuriating to me. So, you know, yeah, just continue to
sue.
Go after the...
There was somebody sometime
in the last year, somewhere around here, who was arrested for prostitution, and I guess it for some reason, I don't know the details, but for some reason it was in their local media, and she was able to sue because she wasn't able to get a job afterwards, and she was able to sue for
defamation.
For and she got $26,000 or something. Now, I don't know the details of the case. Like, I'm kind of guessing for her to be able to do that, she was probably fired from a job, you know, and then actively went out looking for a job and couldn't get another job. So since I haven't been fired from anything, I had already quit, you know, to take the year off as a teacher. So, you know, I don't know that I would be able to do that, but I know it's happened. I know there's a precedent for it. So
that's really
yeah. So that's, you know, that's exciting, but.
Are there any Congress people or, you know, advocates out there that within the government that people could write to about supporting the legalization of prostitution? Anyone that's working on that right now, besides Larry Flint?
You know, I don't know. I don't really know, but people could try to find out.
Yeah, definitely.
I know that there are groups working on drafting the legislation, but I don't know who they're working with. Like, I'm sure that they have hooked up with some people in mainstream politics, but I don't know. I haven't had those conversations like these last. Well, and here's one thing is that I'm probably going to end up working in, you know, prostitutes' rights stuff now, you know, having been thrust into this situation. So, you know, if we talk again,
we'll have you on many more times.
Right.
Then.
So if we talk again in a couple months, I will know way more about what's actually happening. But I do know that, people in the sex worker activist community are really excited about this recent Supreme Court decision, because it basically means that there's an opening there for a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And it just means that they've got a, talk somebody like me into taking their case to the Supreme Court, you know, like, mm-hmm. basically it would mean me going to trial. And then if I lost the trial, lost the case and was convicted, to appeal it and keep appealing it on up to the Supreme Court. And that takes years and a lot of money.
Yep, it does.
But,
we would file a amicus brief, the Friends of the Court brief.
Oh,
we would file
one.
Radical Tea Party would, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, that'll be in the works, like looking for the right person to make the drive to the Supreme Court, you know, so that's very exciting. I mean, I think that we're at kind of on the dawn of a new era, like a new phase in the sex worker activist scene, because there is this real potential now to, because I think a lot of the focus has been on a local level, like the Task Force on Prostitution here that Coyote worked so hard on, you know, but that was a local thing. But this now leaves this opening to go at it from a federal level. So that's really exciting.
Right on. Well, we definitely want to thank Shannon for coming on the Radical Tea Party today.
Thanks for inviting me. It was fun talking into this microphone.
Do you want to hang out? Because we have another like 40 minutes of the show, and we're going to have two artists on who I don't know if you wanted to hang out. We have some questions for them.
Yeah.
But,
well, I may have to,
skedaddle.
Yeah. But,
okay.
But maybe I'll stick around
maybe
for a little bit.
Well,
but I'll probably
so
fade
her,
out
okay.
at some point.
You
but,
may hear Shannon's comments then.
Yeah.
So once again, you are listening to the Radical Tea Party here on Enemy Combatant Radio, streaming to you live from the Mission 24/7. If you guys have, you know, questions for Shannon or, you know, comments of support and you want to call in, the number here is 415-864-1006. And we'll be right back. This is Vice Squad here on Enemy Combatant Radio.
We're ready to lay this one down then.
Or, it's or you're going to suck.
Yeah.
I'm gonna make it.
All right, welcome back to the Radical Tea Party here on Enemy Combatant Radio, streaming to you live from the Mission Rebroadcast on Radio X in Seattle and San Francisco Liberation Radio 93.7 FM here in our own Bucket of the Bay. And continuing on, thanks to Shannon Williams once again for coming in and having a landmark conversation about women's rights and the sex worker movement. And now we're going to kind of shift gears a little bit and talk about an art exhibit that a couple of us went and saw about maybe about a week, 2 weeks ago, The Shooting Gallery. It's a South of Market art gallery located here in San Francisco. And currently there is an exhibit there entitled it's guns and guns, art or weapons, right? Is that
the gun show?
Art or weapons. Art or weapons. Okay, and so in the studio we have three artists from the show, and I'm going to go ahead and have them make a quick introduction. And to my right
is Christopher Jernberg, and I have a painting, but I also do sculpture and multiple mediums.
Tackle the mic there.
This is Brian Teese. I have two paintings in the show, and I also do a wide range of work.
This is Eric. I do painting and printmaking. I have a couple of figurative pieces in the show.
Cool. And if you guys can actually just take that out there if you want. Okay, cool. So when did exactly did you guys when was this show created? It seems like there was a lot of preparation for the show. And
Well, I came across Justin and about maybe 4 or 5 months ago, and he was already working on the show and showed him some of my work, and mine fit in pretty well with the show. I don't know exactly when he started curating the show, but that was when my involvement started. I think it pretty much came up to just before the show opened.
For myself, this is Brian speaking right now. It was something I heard about 2 months prior to the show actually opening up. And for me, this is actually my first gallery show. And it was a show that I was interested in showing. And so I got some pieces ready, and he came over, checked it out, and liked what he saw and filled me in. So for me, it's been a good experience all the way around.
Yeah. And for me, it's the third time around. I had a two-man show with a fellow artist. His name is Yuri Sinakis. In May, and then there was the erotic show in June, and it was just sort of the natural progression to be in the gun show. I did have an interest in the gun show, though, because of that concept of guns being also an aesthetic object. I went to a museum in Stockholm once, and I saw a whole room that was filled with different famous weapons in history, and being behind glass, and it was sort of perceiving them as a sculpture, just an object, instead of having just a loaded association to the weapon that I thought was interesting. So the piece that I put into the gun show, though, it had nothing to do with an actual gun, but it was sort of a multiple reference piece, a text painting that reads, "You're so good, you don't even need to draw," which is sort of a double-edged meaning. And one would be the whole shootout thing, you know, the American West and using guns. And today's that would be more like using your mind and using your words and in the conference room or in any kind of human interaction. And the other end would be, as an artist, I feel more and more coming from a classical background, inclined to do artwork that is less about drawing.
Interesting. The show, we actually went to see a friend of ours, Chucho, had a piece up in the show, and so we went to go check out his work. And while we were there, what would you guys say is the ratio of men to women in terms of artists? Is it an all man show or
no? There's quite a few women in this show. I couldn't really tell you what the ratio is. I think the erotic show actually was much more equal. There was a lot of women in the erotic show.
Right.
I can think of probably 3 or 4 women in this show, but I couldn't really quote an exact number on that. But The erotic show, I think, was more of a even number. I don't know, maybe.
Right.
Maybe well, guys are just more interested in guns. I don't know.
Well, and that's our question. You know, that's an important question to ask. And
well, I actually portray a lot of women with guns and explosives and that kind of stuff. And I don't really know.
Well, I know you guys. Okay. Well, first, let me just diffuse everyone and
it's
hope that they don't
a sexual thing,
they
right?
don't
it's more
they don't
high.
Feel like they're in the total hot seat. But so yeah, this is a woman's typically. You know, we're all women DJs, and so we're really interested in issues that that affect women and how they're seen in society and how they're portrayed. And what really struck me when I went into the show, and again, you guys are kind of speaking on behalf of all of the artists there, so we'll ask our questions to you. But what I was really struck by was how the only human beings that were represented within the show were women, you know, and it was, so there weren't, it wasn't, I didn't actually see any men with guns. Oh, well, maybe there was the gang member piece. Was that?
No, that was an artist by the name of Lance Stronghart. I shot 50 Cent.
I shot 50 Cent. Yeah.
With six slugs in him. It's a six shot, but in my piece, titled California Gold, it's a gold leaf piece, and there is a reference to how California was founded, you know, the gold rush and so forth, and now with much reference to Hollywood and also the adult entertainment industry. And in my particular piece, there's an Oscar figure with two shotguns holding him with two women, nude women straddling
right.
guys in a very sexual erotic way. And yes. So there is some comment with... you know, what's going on in California today and kind of what California is known for.
So let me ask you guys, where does the inspiration for those kinds of pieces come from, and what kind of, artistic significance do women represent for you in terms of their relation to guns? You know, a gun with so many different meanings, a gun as a tool of destruction, a gun as, like a really powerful force. Where do women fit into that? And why is it that we see so many women with guns, half naked, sucking on guns, I don't know, riding guns, and we don't see as many, pictures of women actually killing someone or actually, blowing some guy's head off or something. I don't know. I'm asking you because you're the artists and maybe you have some insight into the artistic.
Well, for me, it's more of, I paint more like about relationships, and the stuff that I have in there, Mischievous, is a Harlequin with the guns. And she's more of a character to me that represented past relationships, past girlfriends, and that I always felt were a little more in control of the relationship. And, so she was more of a character that was wreaking havoc on me than, and it wasn't really, if she blew my head off, I guess I wouldn't be painting here, so.
That's true. It's very true.
She wasn't really a character that was meant to cause any harm. It was more, this was her way of doing things, and if she managed to hurt someone or kill someone in the way of doing it, namely me, then it was just kind of a byproduct. But it was based on past relationships and kind of my feeling that I was in these relationships, but had really no control over the relationship at all. I felt like I was kind of, I don't really know how to put it. I just was out of control. I was not in control of the relationship. Always the woman was. So it was more of a statement to myself about the relationships. So it's not really anything about society or anything like that. Nothing that deep with me. Nothing that deep.
Yeah. And maybe just...
Well, just a thought about what I came up now was what a gun really is. And in my youth, I was growing up in Sweden. I was in the army as a drill instructor, a boot camp instructor. And we were trained with weapons, obviously. But, it's amazing just the power of holding a gun in your hand and training with it. And just...
I agree.
I remember when I had to turn the gun in at the end of my service, and it was just, serious attachments to it. So when
it's power,
because it's an incredible feeling of security, having a gun in your hand, and it kind of sneaked up on me. So when you were talking about your girlfriend, like, or a woman holding a gun, it's sort of a person holding power in their hand.
Yeah, for me, it was holding the power over me mostly. I really don't like guns too much. I feel that if I have the guns myself, I feel more like I'm out of control. I'm going to shoot my foot off.
Do you own a gun?
Well, no.
Okay.
I have a BB gun. Any of the guns that are in the paintings are usually toy guns and that kind of stuff. I think I'm more like Barney Fife. I'm going to shoot my foot off if you give me a gun.
That's scary. And
for myself, with the particular piece, it was not that I was singling out necessarily women or guns or whatever. It was more of a reflection of what I saw was going on and what I saw was happening in this day and age. And, you know, a gun is a symbol of power, and, you know, it's made to take life. I think women to a lot of men is something that's almost, you know, they're people and it's, they're almost hard to, I don't know where I'm going with this.
where are you going with this? He's thinking about those women on top of the Oscar. This is like, Well, I think it's, you know, it's important to talk about, you know, I mean, because I'm sure, well, we actually talked to a lot of the people that were at the exhibit, and a lot of the women, you know, and not just the drunk ones, but the ones that hadn't had a lot of wine, you know, liked the pieces and really thought that they were, you know, kind of provocative and all these different things. And, you know, and so it was kind of like split down the middle. And I think it's important to talk about, you know, whether or not, you know, where this goes beyond just like pop culture, you know, images of like guns and, you know, because for an exhibit that is supposed to be addressing like guns as art or are they weapons, a lot of issues still weren't portrayed, you know, in this exhibit in terms of, you know, like our government's attachment to weapons and how weapons have been used wrongly, you know, not just with, you know, not just for self-defense or anything like that, but not just in a pop culture sense of like, you know, toy guns and don't they look cool, but like, you know, this is serious. Like we have gang warfare, we have guns trading that goes into Latin America that's cost hundreds of thousands of lives. Like, so where do those issues fit into this exhibit as well, you know? And do you feel like there were artists that really kind of tapped into that message?
I think Yuri's piece with the bulletproof lunchbox really kind of taps into that. But
the bulletproof lunchbox.
The bulletproof lunchbox. Yeah, that definitely, to me, was the strongest piece as far as tapping into a real social, political statement towards guns and our society. For me, it's just, I don't try and make any social statements. Everything's a statement about, if I make a statement at all, it's more of a personal statement. You know, and I actually was surprised that I found that as I started painting, I was painting for myself, and I figured that the people who are going to be interested in my work were going to be more like me, kind of Generation X guys kind of thing. And I found out as I went along that at least 50% of my following that I've built over the last couple of years is women, at least 50%.
Why do you think that is?
I think because I tend to portray women stronger. I paint generally always a single female, a lot of times nude, but at the same time, it's not meant to be kind of, they're not meant to be submissive. Like I said earlier, they're usually meant to be in more of a dominating kind of figure. And, you know, for me, it was just painting my own feelings, but I found that as women started to look at it, they liked it, and they've become an important audience for me. And so I think about that. I consider that when I work on future work, I consider how my audience is going to react to this piece. And for me, doing art is a way of communicating whatever message I have at the time, and I have to communicate it effectively, and I don't want to alienate any of my, what I would consider my audience. Right. So I'm very kind of, what's the word? I keep that in the forefront of my mind as I work on new concepts. And I may decide that I'm just going to go with an idea no matter what, but I do at least consider how they're going to feel about that work.
Right. So. Do you guys feel that the link or the sexualization of women and in terms of weapons, is that a harmful thing? Like a random question, throw out there.
Well, immediately the first thing that
comes obviously
to mind
you wouldn't think
is,
it's harmful if you're painting it, but
right,
I mean,
yeah, I mean,
thinking about it,
yeah, it's perception. I mean, you can interpret it that way, or I think most young men, their first introduction to this topic would be James Bond. I mean, that's what it was for me growing up, and so you see this sexy guy with his guns and these really hot women around him, and you know, it's kind of like, cool, I want to be like that. You know, I want to be the super suave, you know, secret agent guy and, you know, do everything right and have these beautiful women wanting me all the time. I mean, and, you know, that's a whole issue in itself. You could take that and dissect it and make what you want out of it. But, you know, we're sexual creatures, we're sexual beings. I think almost any man enjoys sex, I would hope. And most women, I think, enjoy sex, I hope. And
it depends on who it's with.
It depends on who it's with, right? But in general.
Mr. Vibe and I, he's great, but some guys, no. Well, yeah, I think that, you know, obviously there within the media, there's tons of different, you know, and you have to look no further than trade magazines. And I think one of the artists that couldn't make it out here today was the one that did the piece with the woman with the gun in front of the American flag straight out of a trade magazine, practically. And
well, that was kind of the purpose with his. I can't speak for him, but
right.
Just in the little bit that I've talked to him about him, that was kind of a larger series that he did a while back. And I'm trying to think. We did an interview with him just a couple of weeks ago. I can't really remember. You know, he talked a lot about the meanings of those paintings, but they weren't like a pro-gun kind of thing or anything like that. It was, I think it was more of a composition and the idea and that. But anyway, I'm babbling.
No, it's okay. No, I think that it's definitely a difficult topic to talk about. And I think that it's really important because when you're dealing with an issue like guns and like you said, power, this is something about power, you know, who holds power in our country, you know, who doesn't hold power, you know, how is that power used against other people, you know? And I think that it is really important for artists who in and of themselves have a lot of power within their communities, within, you know, their businesses, you know, how do they reflect that and how do they question those things within their work, you know? And I think that a lot of what I'm hearing from you guys is that, you know, when a woman holds a gun, well, she's the one that's in power, you know? And, you know, something that I know I would like to see in art is how is a questioning and a challenging of how is that power used against women, you know, and how is it, you know, still continuing to happen in our country that guns, are continually used against women in violent ways, you know, and that, I don't know.
That's not just a subject of guns being used against women in violent ways, but guns being used against everybody in violent ways.
True.
So for me, the gun thing is not really a gender issue. It's something that's an issue in general. So
right.
I think it's more important to deal with it as just a serious issue and not an issue of guns being used against women. Guns really shouldn't be used against anybody as far as I am concerned.
That's true.
Well, they're made for one purpose only, and that is to kill.
Well, I guess the thoughts that keeps running through my head in this listening to this is when I did my piece, instead of doing an actual gun, you know, that seems sort of the obvious thing, I deconstructed it. What is a gun, really? And that's why I brought up the whole power thing. But another thing that came to my mind now was that art usually comes in the form of a juxtaposition of symbols. And this time it was a gun, and what is that a symbol of, and the whole power structure. But the problem that I see is that we tend to judge things about what we see and what's on the surface and what's visible and what's tangible. And when it comes to power structures, I think at this point, who really is in power, who really is pushing the buttons, it's become such a complicated maze that it would really take a full-time job to figure out what's really going on, who's calling the shots. And that's why I said in my painting, you're so good, you don't even need to draw the gun at this point. And when somebody's using guns and when somebody's showing guns or this and that, people respond to that, and that might be a manipulation tool that is beyond really what I think most people really can comprehend, including myself. That was just a thought I had.
So to go off of that, would you ever see a gun, especially in the hands of someone that's kind of aiming it at someone else, as kind of a false front, you know, a crutch, if you will, you know, of not necessarily of power in some ways, but almost of, you know, cowardice. I mean, I need a gun. I need a gun to kind of extend this self-image of myself, you know, onto other people. And it's like you said, like a manipulation of, you know, other people aren't even going to, they're not going to draw, they're not going to continue to do anything because they see the gun and that stops them right there. And it's not because of this person's power or their strength or their character or whatever, but just because they see that gun and it's like, well, obviously this is an unequal match, you know, like this is a gun. It's an entity in and of itself. And in a way it's, you know, you're kind of depending on that gun's own identity to protect yourself, you know? And I think, and to me, I guess that was one of the most interesting things is that obviously in every artist's work, you see a representation or a reflection of themselves in their pieces. But what I never really saw was a representation of like the actual person in terms of like a physical, like, you know, link to them in some way, you know, like this is like me in a way in my painting. And so in a way I was like, you know, is this a way to like have a barrier around like who I really am too? Is this kind of a crutch in and of itself? You know, like a gun is a crutch in physicality, but in a painting it's even more so. I don't know. Maybe does anyone want to tackle that?
Well, for me, the mischievous paintings are much more of my interaction with the actual girl in the painting. So there, it is a lot about me because it's about what I feel that she's doing, the girl right. in the painting is doing to me. So I may not be in the painting, but I definitely intend all of that series of paintings to be directed at me or the viewer. So, you know, I agree with the fact that it's a crutch, but I forgot where I was going with this.
You agree it's a crutch, okay. Sometimes we need crutches, okay.
let's take that. I don't know. I mean, it's always nice when somebody just walks out center stage and just says, here I am, you know. But a lot of times when people do, you know, have the courage to do that, or
people throw tomatoes at them.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, you know, you get all this unwanted sort of misunderstandings and so forth. And I think that's why it is a natural defense mechanism to just sort of be a little bit more obscure and perhaps a little bit more symbolic. And I don't know, for some reason, Andy Warhol comes up right now, like how when they would ask him point blank, you know, what is this? You know, he would just say yes, no, no, yes, no. Instead of sort of going into this elaborate discussion about it, because then you become a target, you know, you're a moving target all of a sudden, you know. And they're like, haha, you know, you said this thing here and that means this. And then the whole thing is, you know, rolling.
I think that, you know, as a culture, we all live in fear. And I think that, you know, when we do have something that gives us immediate power, that it makes us feel, you know, it covers up some of our insecurities in some ways and our doubts about ourselves. And so, you know, if you're threatened in a situation, you do pull out a gun, you do feel like you have the upper hand. Not that mm-hmm. I've personally been in any situation like that, but just knowing the power behind shooting guns myself, you know, seeing what can happen, you know, it's a big thing. And so in this society, you know, people tend to take the easy way out. There's a less recognition of courage and integrity and so forth. And those things are just not looked upon. I mean, it's very much here and now. What's the fastest way to get there? And, you know, it kind of reflects not only, you know, on ourselves, but also the society that we live in, you know, through the government and capitalism and everything else, you know, from the top down to the bottom. I mean, everything that happens at the top of the infrastructure affects everything at the bottom.
Interesting. I'm going to also include some of the other
people that we still have in the studio, and if Shannon and DJ Andrea want to jump in with some comments or questions. Andrea, and we'll switch those mics.
Yeah, I'm pretty interested in what y'all are saying about, you feel like it's an empowerment symbol to give a gun to women. And I kind of have an anecdote about that. Is once upon a time, I went on a tour, the Black Panther tour of Oakland. And I'm going on this tour with this man in his 50s who was a former member of the Black Panther Party. And I had all my questions already for the tour because I've been studying up. And I said, well, you know, excuse me, Mr. So-and-so. I won't say who he was. What about the women in the Panther Party? We haven't talked about the women in the Panther Party and how about their voice in the Panther Party? And, you know, there's been a lot of come out in the most recent years about how women were really felt like they weren't full participants of the party. And he actually said to me, well, they had guns right beside us. And that was his response to, they had power too. They had guns beside us. They didn't have power. That, in the end, it was the chairman of the Black Panther Party, a man who's saying when to pull that gun. It's him that's saying, you know, it's him that wields the power. And the symbolism of, you know, a beautiful woman with an afro with a gun became this really powerful thing. But it was an empty power because these women weren't empowered in their own organization. So, and I kind of feel the same way about, so just to throw an image out there of a woman with a gun is not empowering her, especially if I feel like that woman doesn't look anything like I look, you know. I mean, it's the same feeling of I checked out your website and stuff, and I don't have any girlfriends that look like that, you know, and I'm sorry, and it's not really empowering. It's the kind of feeling I get when I look at Vogue, and I'm like, it makes you small. It doesn't empower me. It doesn't. So I kind of wonder what you guys think about my little stories.
No, I think you're definitely right about, especially what we're saying about the Black Panther thing. I mean, yeah, he could say there's women with guns, but that's a false sense of imagery. I mean, that's, you know, it's obviously that the men were in control, and this is still very much a man-based society of, power-based. But I get my brain just went completely. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, I'm being just very spontaneous now, so, you know, bear with me. But I keep thinking that these are all details, and that who is really calling the shots is behind the scenes. And I'm from Sweden, so the first 20 years of my life, I lived in a very different society than this one, and it's been a real, you know, wake-up call the last 11 years. And one of the first things that I was confronted with was the whole tension between men and women when I first came here, because I never had experienced that before. And I've been analyzing it a lot, like, why is there this tension between men and women in America that in Sweden is just, I never experienced it that way. You know, you're buddies. You're on the same level. And I think my conclusion comes down to that America is a very young country. There might be railroads, there might be computers, there might be this and that, but to me, it's still the frontier. It's still an early stage. And even though you have a lot of new technology and new ideas and access to it, especially not through the internet, I think culturally, and because of the incredible diversity and people coming in and out, it's still a country that is just desperately trying to keep a certain harmony going. And that's why there is all this conflict and all these people feeling like they've been victimized or people oppressing others and manipulation and power struggles and so forth. As opposed to a country like Sweden that for a long, long... I mean, we haven't been to war for 200 years, you know. So it's a very different situation. I think a more humane and a more equal look on things and sensitivity and so forth comes from that. While as America, it's a very chaotic place. And back to the whole gun thing, it's just a symbol. Guns, it's a very primitive way, but it's something that we can see and that is tangible, but real power comes from someplace else.
As far as my work goes, though, it was never meant. Guns with women were never meant as a symbol of empowerment over the women. It was meant more of a symbol of unempowerment for myself within a relationship. I always felt, like I said earlier, that when I was in a relationship, there's this girl that I'm totally attracted to, and I just have, like, no say in the relationship. I just kind of go wherever it goes. And I, mm-hmm. lack of control doesn't mean I'm trying to control her, but I'm trying to, like, have some sort of say in where things go and being happy and that. And I always found that I'm attracted to this girl. I just can't help myself. Whatever happens, I just kind of fall with it. And it's just a lack of control for myself, within myself. I can't seem to keep control of my own life and that. And that was more of a statement within my work. It really wasn't anything about women with guns have power. It was, like I said, mischievous is more the interaction of the girl with me. And it was my lack of power, my lack of any kind of say in the relationship, more than her sense of power. So it was much more personal thing than a society.
Do you want
to? No, I was just thinking that what comes up now is that, you know, what is art really? And what is it to the maker and what is it to the viewer? And I think in this case, what I'm seeing is that art is art because our culture says it is, mm-hmm. meaning that if another culture considers something to be art and we don't, it's not art anymore. So art is an agreement in that sense. So your artwork, it means something to somebody else. Doesn't necessarily mean it means something to you.
Yeah.
But there is a sort of a, when you make an art piece and you put it into a gallery, you are showing it to the culture and to society. Like Serrano was showing his Piss Christ picture, and we all know what happened with that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And to him, it didn't really mean that, what the way people perceived that piece to be, you know? But that was sort of overlooked, and they were like, this guy is just a bastard, you know? And I don't know what he really thought about that whole thing, but I do know what that really meant to him, you know, coming from a Catholic background and seeing how religion has corrupted spirituality in that sense. But he was actually a person who is very spiritual.
Well, actually, I did find that, to your point, that everybody seems to have a different point of view, or they read something different into the work. So while I remember the first time someone came into my studio and said, oh, so you're an erotic artist. And I said, what do you mean? I'm not an erotic artist. And they go, but you have a nude woman. I go, so? It to me at the time, it had nothing to do with eroticism, but somebody else perceived it as erotic art. And it took me quite a while to kind of come to terms with that. I go, okay.
So what kind of art would you consider it to be? Like if you had to kind of put a label on it, or?
Well, I probably come more to the fact that I tend to be more of a pop erotic.
Pop erotic.
Pop erotic. You know, I tend to deal a lot
so
with.
So it's not erotic, it's pop erotic.
Well, this is the thing, is I came to terms with that. I go, okay, you know, maybe it is erotic. It's my intention never was eroticism when I did it. I do keep that in mind more now. You know, mm-hmm. as I create imagery, I kind of keep in mind the eroticism. And I'm doing a lot more stuff. The newer stuff, there's a lot less nudity, but it's far more provocative.
Mm-hmm.
So there is more of eroticism to the newer stuff.
What is the newer stuff like?
You'll have to wait and see it.
We'll have to wait to see
a solo okay. show at the shooting gallery in February. So, see that.
So does eroticism sell? Is that like why do you think that people, you know, create eroticism for? And I mean eroticism for a certain audience, because I think you know, Andrea pointed out that the women that she sees in the paintings that she sees all the time and in magazines don't look like her, you know, and they don't look like her friends. They don't look like her family, and they don't look like her people in her community. They look like people that she sees on runways, you know, and it's like, so obviously it's a certain audience. It's a target audience that's being catered to. And is that why, is it a big, you know, industry? Is that why it sells? Like, does it?
It's actually funny, 'cause I've had quite a bit of dealing with this, because a lot of people try and push my stuff more into the pinup market, which I don't really want to be part of. And so they try and say, well, you should be painting this blonde, big-breasted girl. And I say, well, you know, that's not really – I paint the girls I'm attracted to because I paint the paintings first for myself. So it, if I do any kind of eroticism, it's something that's a little more erotic to me. And so I tend to work with girls that I find more attractive. But I do find that if I want to speak to my public and the public that I'm speaking to at the time is interested in this type of girl, I want to get my concept across. Sometimes I will actually change the girl that I would use kind of like sometimes against my better judgment and use a girl that kind of fits that stereotypical runway type model, Playboy model. I tend to do some of those just to kind of get the message across in there and then do a little more that or more what I'm attracted to, which is definitely not the Playboy type model. I tend to not be attracted to the fake breasts, blonde hair, fake blonde hair. You know, I've worked with a few of those models.
No, I wanted to say that, I mean, because this, being an artist and concerned with aesthetics is something that I really thought about a lot. And the other day I went to see the French movie Swimming Pool.
Oh, yeah.
And I was so happy when I saw that movie because, first of all, there was no real plot, so it wasn't really Hollywood. And the person I went to went with to see the movie, you know, we talked about it afterwards, and I said to her, that's the difference between America and Europe. I'm talking in generality now. Of course, there are people here that, you know, are not like that, but you look at Hollywood in general, like, there's this plot-driven, there's, like, things has to happen, you know, those people fall asleep. Well, as in Europe, you can just watch somebody eat a croissant, drink a cup of coffee, and I feel fulfilled by that because it's a certain atmosphere. But the point I wanted to get to was the men in that movie was what really, you know, stood out to me because I was like, this guy looks just like me, you know. This is not a Ken doll. This is not a perfect six-pack guy. This guy is flabby. He smokes, he drinks, he eats, you know. Like, this guy, you know, looks like, you know, I look, you know, and then I hear the people in the audience being like, ooh, what the hell is wrong with this guy, you know, and like wearing his little Speedos and having his belly. And I was really liberated by that whole thing. So I don't know, when I talk to my students, I'm always surprised that when I ask them, what's the ethic of America? And nobody knows what the ethic of America is.
To make money.
Well, that's what they say, but I mean more historically the Judeo-Protestant ethic and the ultra-individualism as opposed to collectivism in the East and Europe being somewhere in between or the mix of the two.
You know, that's one of the things everyone says, the ultra-individualism, but it's not really. I mean, take pretty much like the whole Middle East thing and the recall election. Nobody ever actually gives a good reason for doing it. They just say, they've got weapons of mass destruction. And you say, well, show it. No, I can't show it to you, but they have them. You have to believe me. So everyone goes, well, if you say they have them, they must have them. So they go, okay, let's go bomb them. Mm-hmm. You know, let's recall. I haven't been given any kind of reason, you know, but he says it's a good idea, so let's do it. There's a lot of blind kind of following.
Right,
I would pretty much agree with that statement. That has nothing really to do with the gun show or anything.
It's okay. Did you have another follow-up comment to it? Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay. I think that, I mean, obviously, and I think that's one of the things that I really, you know, especially when it comes to art, because I brought a friend with me too, who's also a friend of Chucho's, and we actually had a really long discussion about the show, and I said, well, you know, don't, because at that time I was, you know, I was looking, you know, I was really kind of turned off by the women in a lot of the pictures because I just felt like, well, that's not really exploring, you know, the connections between women and guns, you know, and like these, you know, and it's not really, it's kind of just pop. It's just kind of like,
I don't know if that was necessarily our main point to do.
Right. And I said, well, if you're going to have a show about guns and debate about whether or not, you know, is it just art, which I think that everyone can probably agree. Well, obviously a gun is not just art. It's meant to kill. Like you said earlier, you know, it has one purpose, to kill. And so obviously, you know, that's not an art, but you know,
And then the other side of that is like, is it a weapon? Well, yeah, it's a weapon, but it's not just a weapon. It, you know, it has that you use once or twice. Like it has, you know, ramifications that stretch over, you know, hundreds of years. And, you know, and then when you put all these women in these pictures, it's like, well, is it just like, you know, what's that game show with Bob Barker? Oh, Price is Right. Is it just like Price is Right, where the women are just there to like showcase it? Like, this is a washing machine, you know, and I'm wearing a dress by Giorgio Armani or whatever, you know, or is the woman, you know, have a function in that piece? Does she have a function that's supposed to create a message? And what is that message?
I guess in my particular piece, mine was a very blunt statement about what I felt was something that, you know, regardless of the people being portrayed in my painting, it was what is reality, what is selling, what is making a lot of money. And that is, when I think of Hollywood, I think of guns. I think of, you know, these extreme, really sexed up bodies that, you know, not a lot of people might have, but that's what a lot of people have their ideals about. And when you look at a porn star, you know, they don't necessarily look like every woman out in the street, but they have a certain look about them. There is a certain mystique, a certain, you know, physical.